I really see the scientific panel as genuinely groundbreaking.
It's the world's first global scientific body specifically for AI. We're seeing major developments every few months or even weeks. So the panel can provide evidence-based assessments that hopefully everyone can trust as a common reference point.
Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of Multilateralism Unpacked, the podcast of the United Nations University Center for Policy Research. I'm Eleanor Forney-Toombs, Head of Anticipatory Action and Innovation at UNU CPR. Artificial intelligence has rapidly become one of the most transformative technologies of our time, from reshaping industries and labor markets to influencing education, healthcare, and security. AI is increasingly embedded in every part of our societies. Although there is increasing convergence on what might be the risks and opportunities of AI, the policy solutions are diverse and fragmented. Standards, sectoral regulations, and strategies vary from country to country. Increasingly, though, initiatives for the global governance of AI have created room for dialogue and cooperation with the aim of informing better solutions to mitigate risks and harness AI's potential for public good. Over the last few years, the United Nations has provided a platform for global dialogue and scientific consensus on AI. During this year's 80th General Assembly, member states launched the International Scientific Panel on AI, designed to build a common, evidence-based understanding of the technology, and the Global Dialogues on AI, bringing together governments, civil society, industry, and academia to exchange perspectives on a regular basis. To help us understand where global AI governance stands today, what these new initiatives mean in practice, and how AI governance may evolve in the years ahead, I spoke to Lucia Velasco, Head of AI Policy at the UN Office for Digital and Emergent Technologies. Lucia has been directly involved in shaping AI processes at the UN and is also the author of Te va a sustituir un algoritmo? Will an algorithm replace you? A book that examines how automation and AI are reshaping work and society.
Lucia, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
We're very happy to have you here with us today. So I was wondering, just to set the stage a little bit, could you start by telling us a bit about your role as head of AI policy in the UN Tech Envoy's office and why this new position was created in the UN Secretariat?
Yeah, I still remember when the Tech Envoy role was created. At the time, I was in the Spanish government working on AI policy, and I thought it's exactly what the UN needs. I wrote to carry forward the Secretary General's vision for digital cooperation. Fast forward a few years, I joined the team inspired by what the Tech Envoy was trying to accomplish. And when member states adopted the Global Digital Compact at the Summit of the Future in 2024, one of its provisions was to strengthen the UN's ability to deal with digital and emerging technologies. With that, the General Assembly decided to establish the Office for Digital and Emerging Technologies, building on the work of the Tech Envoy and making it part of the UN Secretariat. This office is now the UN's anchor for digital cooperation, and its mandate is to advance basically the Global Digital Compact, advise the Secretary General, and coordinate across the UN system. And at its heart, it's about supporting member states and stakeholders, making sure their priorities and expertise are reflected in the UN. So the global cooperation on technology, on artificial intelligence, is actually inclusive, practical, and evidence-based.
That's so interesting. And I do have a follow-up question on this. You and I work together to support the work of the High-Level Advisory Body on AI, which influenced the Global Digital Compact and where we are now in AI policy. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what that process was and the real impact that they had on the International Scientific Panel on AI and what we're going to talk about next.
That's right. And that was a fascinating process. You were leading the research side and I was supporting the High-Level Advisory Body. And this high-level week of the General Assembly felt like a culmination moment after this last 2 years. It felt like everything we've been building finally came together. It really started, as you said, with the Secretary General's high-level advisory body back in 2023, which produced the report Governing AI for Humanity and recommended the creation of actually these two mechanisms that were adopted, that were created very recently. The International Panel and the Global Dialogue, I'm sure we will talk about them in a minute, but the work of the high-level advisory body fed into the Global Digital Compact, and then the member states in August 2025 adopted by consensus through a resolution co-facilitated by Spain and Costa Rica the creation of this, both the panel and the dialogue. So it feels like the end of a journey in a way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. And so they made these recommendations for, you know, future architecture of global AI governance. And now one of these recommendations was the creation of the International Scientific Panel on AI. So what this does is it allows for global scientific consensus on AI as a foundation for policies and regulations at the national and perhaps even international level. So I was wondering, what do you hope the International Scientific Panel might achieve? And I'm also wondering, specifically from your perspective, what do you think would be the most significant challenges to its work being impactful?
Yeah, you know, throughout this process, I personally learned a lot. Not only the outcome, because when you think about how divided countries often are on technology and specifically on artificial intelligence, the level of collective agreement, meaning 193 countries, again, by consensus, agreed on creating a panel and a dialogue is really inspiring. But through the process that I had the pleasure of supporting with my office, what stood out most was the commitment of the delegates. You know, the diplomats spending countless hours negotiating over the course of a year to find common ground. So we're talking about weekends, holidays. It didn't matter until they reached an agreement. And mm-hmm. that kind of sustained effort shows me there is hope. So here is my small tribute to all of them who made it happen. And to your question, I really see the scientific panel as genuinely groundbreaking.
It's the world's first global scientific body specifically for AI. And people have been comparing it to the IPCC, the mm-hmm. climate panel.
Yeah.
And I think that's a helpful comparison. But AI is different. And you know this very well. Climate science moves relatively slowly, and, you know, we're talking about decades. It's also the periodicity of the IPCC's report. But AI, we're seeing major developments every few months or even weeks. So we have to figure out how to do rigorous scientific assessment, but at a pace that's actually useful for policymakers. And you were also asking what I'm hoping for. I think that first we desperately need authoritative information that cuts through all the noise. There's so much hype around AI, promises of utopia, and also so much fear-mongering, warnings of, you know, the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And yeah, policymakers, and I say this after being a policymaker for many years, are trying to make decisions, but they're getting widely different messages from different sources. So the panel can provide evidence-based assessments that hopefully everyone can trust as a common reference point. Second, it can help build common ground between countries with very different perspectives. And with this, I mean, some countries are worried primarily about economic competitiveness, others about human rights, others about maintaining sovereignty and not becoming dependent on foreign technology. But if we can't at least agree on the scientific facts, what AI can and can't actually do, what the real risks are versus what's overblown, then we have a foundation for those policy conversations. You can disagree on policy choices, but at least you're working from the same factual base. And third and last, and I think this is very, very important, it ensures that scientific evidence guides AI governance, not just commercial interests or political posturing. So we need that independent, credible voice.
It's so interesting. And I think it's something that maybe people are not realizing right now, that the panel is actually very different from the high-level advisory body, because a high-level advisory body was making policy recommendations, whereas the panel is doing scientific consensus. What is AI? What are the risks of AI? What are the opportunities of AI? But it's not making policy recommendations. And I think that's really interesting to keep in mind. This idea of scientific consensus is about the state of the science today, as opposed to what we really want to do about it. And I think that kind of leads to my next question, which is about the participants. Who's going to be on this panel? And so your office just launched the call for candidates to the panel, and it's closing on October 31, if anybody wants to apply. And I was wondering what will be the criteria for participation, and what is the specific expertise that your office is most hoping to be able to fill?
Yeah, that's it's a very, very important comment you just made. And sometimes when you're in it, you think it's obvious from the names that these are different groups, I would say. But one was the Secretary General's high-level advisory body on AI. So it was his, you know, high-level working group advising him. Mm-hmm. And that had a purpose, and it required certain profiles. It was, you know, as diverse as it can get. And you have from policymakers to scientists to civil society, gender balance, and geographically representative. And that, you know, working group, that advisory body did an amazing job and actually delivered this report to the SG, and obviously is public and influenced the Global Digital Compact, as we mentioned earlier. The International Independent Scientific Panel on AI is meant to be the most important scientific body of the world looking at AI. It's created by 193 countries to actually assess the technology without being prescriptive, without being policy prescriptive, but being policy relevant. And they're trying to get the best talent of the world from every region, obviously, and gender balance. Once again, this is a very different profile. And this, as the General Assembly has agreed, should be a body conformed by the most outstanding experts on AI and related fields. So that's kind of the profile.
That's so interesting. And I think the UN has a history with this, with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And if you actually look at the history of this, there's a book from the 1960s by Thomas Kuhn called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And it talks about the need, in order to move forward in a technological or a scientific revolution, the need for technical and scientific consensus. And that we're at kind of the beginning of the AI revolution, and we need to agree on what the technology is in order to best be able to harness its benefits. So there's an actual very interesting theoretical foundation for this. And the fact that the UN has done this in a number of different domains, in nuclear energy, in civil aviation, in climate change, anywhere where it's seen kind of a big scientific or technological question. And so I think that's so interesting.
Yes, following on that, one of the differences that I find also very, very interesting from this panel that has been, you know, created, again, it's not the UN creating a panel, it's 193 countries agreeing for a panel to be created within the United Nations. So I think that's a nuance, but it's important. It's not an initiative from the Secretary General, it's an initiative from the countries.
Yeah.
So this is the first time that we don't have an intergovernmental panel, which is, you know, intergovernment, but an independent scientific panel, which is also, you know, a step further in how we understand the independence of science and the importance of independent scientific assessments in such a critical technology. And this is connected to the challenges, and I think you were asking earlier about them, and I'm not sure I answered, but we briefly mentioned the speed of AI development, probably the biggest one, and how do you publish this annual report when the technology might change fundamentally in 6 months. And we've seen this with other reports who are doing a similar exercise, more focused on risks of advanced AI, and chaired by Professor Bengio, where basically there had to be an update because the technology just changed.
Yeah.
But there's also the question of independence. And to me, you know, that's going to be important. The panel members serve in their personal capacity, not representing governments or companies. They should be scientists. They should have outstanding expertise. But I also can imagine there will be pressure, subtle or not so subtle, and the panel's credibility will depend on resisting that. And lastly, I worry a lot about capacity gaps. And, you know, coming from Spain, but also being half Argentinian, I obviously notice that most AI expertise and infrastructure is concentrated in a handful of countries. Mm-hmm. And we need perspectives from everywhere, including developing countries and other parts of the world that are not the global north. So that means making sure experts from those countries actually have the support, the resources, and the institutional backing to participate fully. Because if someone's brilliant but doesn't have the research funding, the computing resources, or even reliable internet connectivity, how do they contribute equally, right? So that's a real structural challenge we need to address.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're saying that because I think there's a lot of parallels to this idea also of participation in international standards, where we've seen a lot of interest in researchers from the global south and value researchers from the global south taking part in the development of international standards at ITU, at ISO, and so on. But the pipeline for their participation has been tricky. So do they have enough resources? Are they able to come in person? Are they able to bring the learnings back into their countries? And so there's a whole pipeline for participation in these global scientific processes that's really important to keep in mind.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, women know a lot about this, but it's not only being able to travel and participate and not having any or having the support back home also to do that, but it's actually having the time to prepare the meetings, to actually engage, to have access to the resources, even to scientific publications. You need to pay for most of them or have them through your institution. So, you know, a lot of things we take for granted here in New York, but it's not the same in the rest of the world. And we need to be mindful when we design these mechanisms and secure meaningful participation from across the globe and from across different realities.
I definitely agree. And I think there should be childcare for the panel. I'll make that recommendation. Okay, so I want to move on to the Global Dialogues on AI. So they were also launched on September 25th as an important forum through which international cooperation and discussion on AI can take place in a consistent way. So this is a separate kind of recommendation or policy initiative than the scientific panel. And so I was wondering if you could tell us what is the aim of these dialogues and how will they connect with the work of the International Scientific Panel and of other AI governance initiatives globally?
Yeah, so the dialogues are different from the panel. They are the political and multi-stakeholder complement to the scientific work. They launched on September 25th, 2025, and the Secretary General captured perfectly. He said, for the first time, every country will have a seat at the table in shaping international cooperation on AI governance. And that matters because so much AI governance happens in exclusive forums. Mm-hmm. This dialogue is universal. Every UN member state, plus private sector, civil society, academia, and technical community will be there. And the aim, it's about creating a consistent space for sharing best practices, learning from each other's experiences, making governance approaches more interoperable. If an AI incident happens in one country, others should be able to learn from it and build common ground on priority issues. But I think it's really, really important because there's a lot of confusion around this. It's not top-down regulation. The resolution and the UN obviously respects national sovereignty. This is not about regulating AI. This is about creating a platform where dialogue on different approaches to AI governance can happen. Different countries have different values, legal systems, development levels. It's all about dialogue and trying to coordinate, not to dictate. And, you know, the panel and the dialogues are designed to work together in a kind of a virtuous circle, and the resolution that creates them tries to explain that. Every year, the panel will present its scientific assessment at the dialogue, evidence informing policy discussion, and then policy changes help identify what research the panel should prioritize mm-hmm. next. So it's kind of, yeah, that virtuous cycle. The first dialogue will happen in Geneva in July 2026, then New York 2027, and they'll alternate.
It's really interesting. And I was wondering, so the UN already has an AI forum, which is headed by ITU, which is the AI for Good conference. And I believe, if I understand correctly, the first global dialogue will take place on the margins of the AI for Good conference in Geneva. And I was wondering, what is the distinction between the two conferences from your perspective?
Yeah, I would say that the main difference is that this dialogue has been created by 193 countries here mm-hmm. at the General Assembly, and it institutionalizes a global dialogue on AI governance in the United Nations.
Right. Is it more similar to some of the climate change meetings that we have, for example, the COP meetings?
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay. Same. And comes from the same place.
Mm-hmm. Well, really looking forward to seeing how this develops. I think I'd like to actually take a moment to move on to your book, which is really interesting, and I'm currently reading it. And it's called Te va sustituir un algoritmo. And so you wrote it in Spain, and it explores how automation and AI were, at the time of writing, reshaping jobs and society. And I find it's so interesting because it's a question that is so important today. Every panel that I go to, every time I have a conversation with people, even the informal conversations at the kitchen table, people want to know specifically this, right? They want to know, is AI going to replace my job? Am I going to be able to pay my mortgage? Am I going to be able to send my kids to university? And then what kind of jobs should they focus on and should they have? And so this impact of AI on labor has really shaken people up, and people are very worried. So I find it so interesting that you wrote about this a few years ago. And I was wondering, if you had to rewrite it today, what would be different about your key thesis, if anything at all?
Yeah, thank you for buying it and reading it. It's important for authors, as you well know, because you're also a book author. Yeah, this is a book. I think that now in our lives, we say before ChatGPT and after ChatGPT as that, you know.
Yeah.
Very, very important moment in everyone's life. So this is a pre-ChatGPT book, but I was trying to explain that a ChatGPT kind of moment was coming and how we should be preparing for it. And yeah, I wrote it because the reality back then was very, very different to what you just described. And no one was talking about the impact on jobs, or it was very few people specialized on the topic. And, you know, some economists like myself were seeing that this had a huge potential of impact across societies, across the globe, and really simultaneously. So, you know, we had to start preparing the countries and the policies to a new reality. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, we didn't know exactly what it would look like. Now, I think we have a better idea, although still evolving. And we see the changes every minute, very connected to the increasing capabilities of the technology. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not exactly the same reality, but I would say that the core thesis holds. The question, obviously, isn't whether algorithms will replace us, is how we shape that transition. And mm-hmm. obviously now, after this year's working on international governance of technology, of AI, I would emphasize much more on the need of this international cooperation. I was back then working in a national government, in a European government, and you know, I was looking more at the national possible responses that a country could take. But I think that, you know, those reflections still are relevant. I talked about 4 Ds in the book: demographics, decarbonization, deglobalization, and digitalization, which I think are still relevant. But obviously, you know, now this has changed because digitalization now is more like computational sovereignty, strategic autonomy, and how to avoid AI colonialism. So it's a much more sophisticated conversation. Mm-hmm. But I would also like to tackle more power, who controls AI, whose values get embedded, who benefits. And I would be more into the core of the matter. At that time, I think it was more setting a scene and making sure we were understanding what was coming.
Well, I'm really looking forward to your next book on the issue. I think it would be super interesting.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm looking forward to writing about it.
So at the Global Dialogues on AI launch, we heard from a series of experts about some of the areas of focus for the Global Dialogues. And of course, this covers a lot of ground. And we had Nobel laureate for economics, Acemoglu, who teaches here in the United States. And he spoke about the importance of orienting AI from a demographic perspective and towards AI that would benefit workers. And he argued that this idea of worker replacement and even productivity is a bit of a trap for most people, because if you increase your productivity with AI, the fear is that eventually we'll just need less of you. And I was wondering if you've thought a little bit about those themes and how to reorient AI development towards activities that might be more worker-friendly or more friendly to the regular person.
Yeah, this is probably my favorite question because my research is about this. Obviously, I, like everyone else, admire Acemoglu, and I think he has many interesting theories. One that I like a lot is the so-so automation and, you know, this kind of automation that in the end creates more friction and more work for those who is supposed to help. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. He also has a very interesting point on how this technological change is not going to reflect at the macro level, and I'm very interested in learning more about why this is happening or this will happen and what's wrong in what we measure to have that visibility on the underlying changes that we are already seeing. And thanks to other researchers like Erik Brynjolfsson and others who are now showing the impact of the technology on entry-level jobs. But I think that fundamentally, there are two things that we need to look at. One is we are designing, or technology is being designed to replace workers, to imitate workers. So that inevitably will lead us to replacement instead of augmentation, or in a way of complementarity, or in a way of empowerment. So to me, this is part of the shaping the direction of technological development that should be tackled by countries and by businesses. And the other part has to do with the surplus and what happens when, you know, we get more productive and we start to do the same in less time. Who gets that surplus? Right. Are we going to work less time? Can we choose what are we going to spend that time on? Or is it going to be, you know, taken by businesses and then we work basically more and we do more because technology enables us to be more productive? So that's a conversation to be had and to be agreed by society. I think it's part of the new social contract and these deeper conversation we need to have as societies related to our future.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And it's definitely themes that I think will be discussed in some of these international forums and definitely taken on more at the national and even subnational level, where policymakers are really concerned about their own constituents and what their future might be. So I'm going to ask you one last question. And that's just, if you had one message for policymaker and the public about AI's future, what would it be?
Yeah, I always said the same. This is something that concerns everyone. We are all affected by this technology. You don't need to be a computer scientist to be able to discuss, express your preferences, or help shape the future that is being designed around this technology. So I would invite everyone to involve themselves and make sure that the technology ends up being something positive for humanity and not for just a few.
Great closing words. Thank you so much, Lucia. It was so great to have you here, and look forward to more conversations on the topic.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Lucia Velasco, Head of AI Policy at the Office of Digital and Emerging Technologies. We'll be closely following new developments in the AI governance space in the months ahead. Check back here and visit unu.edu/CPR for research, analysis, and commentary as we continue to explore the implications of AI for the multilateral system.